final 16 days of June, according to reports. Up next, the Empower Hour with Deshauna Spencer. Askia Mohammed has 2:55 p.m. headlines. I'm Gloria Minot.
This is Empower Hour. I'm your host, Deshauna Spencer. Can racism cause PTSD? Yes, according to research, a study found that racial discrimination was associated with increased mental disorders in African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Asian Americans. Black people are more likely to experience race-related PTSD than other racial groups. So what can we do about this? In the studio, well, actually by phone, I am talking to Dr. Wisdom Powell. She is the assistant professor of health behavior at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome to the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for being here and discussing this great conversation we're about to have. If you have any questions or comments, you can call 202-588-0893 or hit me up on Twitter using the hashtag EmpowerHour. So again, thank you, Dr. Powell, for being on the show. So when we talk about the word PTSD, typically people think about veterans of war. But people don't really think about racism as a way of causing PTSD. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think what's important to start out with is just a working definition of what PTSD really is. When we think about PTSD from a clinical perspective, we're really talking about an anxiety disorder. And this anxiety disorder is generally caused by exposure to some catastrophic event that overwhelms a person's coping resources. And for a person to be diagnosed with PTSD, they have to have some reaction or experience that fits into the following criteria, like they have to have intrusive thoughts about it, they have to be avoiding situations and places that remind them of those events, and some sort of arousal symptoms, so difficulty sleeping, for example. So people who are diagnosed with PTSD present with those kinds of clinically diagnosable symptoms. Mm-hmm. What we're really talking about with respect to racism-related events is a potential trauma reaction, but more likely than not, we're talking about a stress response that is the result of a psychological or emotional injury that is presented by the exposure to racism. And that exposure, as we've talked about, can be firsthand, like you could actually be the victim of a racism-related traumatic event, or you can witness someone experiencing a racism-related event, and then that can bring on symptoms that mimic or are very similar to those that we see in PTSD.
It makes me think about what I was having a conversation with my friends the other day, and they were saying that they kind of felt trauma with everything that's been happening in the news. We know what happened in Charleston, and then today there was another story about a young woman who was mm-hmm. killed in police custody, and she was in a sorority. So it really hit home for a lot of people, especially African Americans. And I know with social media these days, I feel like we're kind of exposed to more information anyway, just because of social media. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you keep hearing these stories again and again, and it really can affect your psyche.
It really can. I think one of the things that is a consequence of living in a virtually connected world is that we can be exposed to these events in real time, and we can see firsthand or secondhand what people who are the victims of those crimes experience or what their loved ones express in the aftermath. And I think the chronicity of those kinds of exposure, like being seeing these things over and over, again, can have an impact on our psychological and emotional well-being. The danger is that because, you know, we're seeing these things secondhand, we can discount, you know, what we're feeling or experiencing and have a tendency to think that we don't have a right to have those kinds of reactions because it didn't really happen to us.
Right.
But we know, you know, from clinical data that people can have what we call vicarious or secondhand trauma responses, and that you don't have to be the victim of a traumatic or catastrophic event to experience the kinds of symptoms that can overwhelm your coping ability.
Right, and it makes me think about the survivors of what happened in Charleston. I can only imagine the type of trauma that they would be experiencing after witnessing their church members being murdered right in front of them.
Absolutely. And we will only know in time, and prayerfully, they'll have the kind of support and community resources to help them overcome and manage what could be potentially traumatic reactions to those events. But folks who were in that church who survived but are now living with the aftermath of those of that traumatic massacre will have to be really careful and sort of be aware of and monitor what they're feeling and seeing in the aftermath. It's likely, and it doesn't mean that they're going to necessarily develop PTSD, because PTSD presents itself in individuals based on, you know, other kinds of things they bring to the trauma, you know, the trauma experience. So it varies based on your personality, you know, your style of coping, how many resources or for support you have, what kind of a emotional processor you are. So all of that matters, and so I don't want to say that everyone who was in the church will experience PTSD. That's not true, but it is it puts them at a higher risk for that kind of reaction.
And it makes me think about the case of Khalif Browder. Are you familiar with the young man who committed suicide, I think, in May?
In New York City?
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read about his case, I said I have to do the show on PTSD. I don't know if he had PTSD, but based off of what happened to him, he was in prison for 3 years for stealing mm-hmm. a backpack, and then he gets released. No one apologizes. He was abused in prison, not by some gang members, but also by a police officer, and then he commits suicide back in May. And I saw one of his interviews, and he seemed pretty traumatized. And to me, he exhibited, I'm not a professional, you are, so you can probably, you know, give a better insight than I can about PTSD with that young man. But I feel like I saw that in his mannerisms just by discussing what happened to him when he was at Rikers Island.
I mean, it is possible, and of course, without, you know, him being under my care and me having a systematic evaluation of him, I can't make any, you know, sort of professional diagnosis. But I can say that one of the things that happens as a result of exposure to catastrophic events, especially among groups of people who have a culture of keeping things silent and a culture of pushing down or being emotionally stoic in the face of those kinds of events, like when you have that way of that culture of silence sort of operating in your life, then you're less likely to talk about those experiences and less likely to seek and get help. I mean, I guess the thing we can say is that he was trying to tell people about his experience, and I imagine that expressing, you know, the truths of what happened had some powerful impact on his life in a positive way. But the reality is that if you are experiencing the kind of clinically diagnosable symptoms that I described that are associated with PTSD, you do need professional, you could benefit from professional intervention. And sometimes it's hard for us. I know, and I'm saying us more generally, and of course there's variation, but within the Black community, there is a culture and a history of denying mental health problems. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that stems from a very long history of what, you know, sort of disclosing mental illness meant for people. But also I think it has to do with the culture of silence that was created in the aftermath of our experience early in this country. So, you know, I think we've done a lot of things to help us to survive, but those survival tactics kind of wear thin if you use them and apply them to your everyday life.
Right. I would think our ancestors all experienced some form of PTSD. You think being enslaved and being abused and beaten for decades, and then with the civil rights movement, another round of PTSD. And I feel like it's something that maybe we've never talked about. Maybe people never assumed that it was actually a thing. So I'm happy for you to be talking about this today.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have to be, you know, just careful in how what language we use, you know, when describing these things. And I like to use the word traumatic injury, mm-hmm. As opposed to disorder, because disorder, as Dr. Robert Carter at Columbia University has cautioned us, you know, puts people, the victims or the secondhand witnesses in a pathological category, right? So disorder implies there's something, you know, wrong with you, rather than that the structure or the experience has exacted an emotional injury on mm-hmm. you or taken an emotional toll. So I think that when we think about our ancestors, it's possible that some or many of them experienced diagnosable PTSD, but more likely than not, it's the intrapsychic injury that is caused from, you know, exposure to racism that can disrupt people's emotional and psychological well-being. And that's a different take, although closely related, sort of way of explaining what could have possibly been their experience.
Yeah, that you're so right. I was actually reading an article about workplace, and one gentleman, he was mentioning how he was diagnosed with anxiety after experiencing racism in the workplace. We all know that, unfortunately, in America, when it comes to workplace issues, African Americans do experience. I've experienced it myself when I work at a particular company, and he had a hard time coping at his job because of what he was experiencing from his boss, and he had nightmares. It's something that I wasn't having nightmares with my boss. Actually, I did have one nightmare, actually, one boss that I did not get along. I had this really bad nightmare once, so maybe I had some type of anxiety myself, but it's something that people don't think about. He never thought he had some type of anxiety until he went to a doctor. He didn't realize it was actually his job that was causing it.
Yeah, I mean, it is really easy to fall into what I call the injury trap, in that, you know, when racism happens in our modern experience. Now, Charleston is an example of something that's a blatant sort of race related act of malice that's committed against a group of people. But in most of our lives, we experience racism at a very subtle level. You know, the kind of racism that shows up in the workplace, people discounting your ability or treating you differently or marginalizing you or silencing you in meetings or treating you as if you have gotten a job based on some racial preference, right? And mm-hmm. and those kinds of subtle forms of racism can actually wreak havoc on your psyche and really notable ways. I mean, one of it is the chronicity. I mean, the wear and tear that's produced on your emotional capacity from having to walk in and armor up every day right. for those kinds of experiences can create some psychological distress. And the danger of the kind of racism you just described is that it is so subtle mm-hmm. and that it's difficult to name and detect, and other people will tell you that you're just playing the race card or that you're seeing racism where it is not. But the data does not support that. Like, the data actually suggests that people who are experiencing racism or racial discrimination are more likely to minimize those experiences than to over-report them. So I think that we have to just trust our gut in most of those instances where those experiences arise, and talk to other people about them and find circles of support that can offer a venting space. You need a safe space to be able to talk about them. But you're right. Those kinds of experiences happen to all of us, and I think that I don't know any racial and ethnic minority colleague or friend of mine who hasn't had at least one of those kinds of experiences, and I think that speaks volumes to the fact that racism in those spaces is still alive and well.
I know you mentioned talking about it, and as you mentioned earlier, that people of color, especially African Americans, are less likely to open up and talk about issues such as this. So how can we open up the dialogue and discuss anxiety and race-related PTSD?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is just believe what you're experiencing the first time, right? I think one of the things we do when experiences of racism show up in our lives is that we ruminate, meaning we think about them a lot, and we go back and forth between, it's an inner dialogue that happens. Was it race? Is it me? And there's all of this kind of what we call ambiguity around the experience that people spend a lot of cognitive energy sort of processing. And that actually, I think, takes a toll. But in that process, what we can end up doing is just saying, well, maybe it wasn't, and maybe I shouldn't talk about it. So the first thing I think we have to do is to find a support network. We have been doing a lot of work with the Community Healing Network, an organization on which I serve the board, where we are setting up emotional emancipation circles or healing circles for people to come together in communities and talk about the racism that they're experiencing and to work collectively to create a circle of healing and compassion. I think that's really the first step to, getting through an experience. Like, you have to get real about it. And avoiding it, as we've seen in this more diagnostic criteria, actually can lead to an amplification of the symptom. So avoiding it doesn't work. And then I think the second thing is that we have to be kind to ourselves, in the moment if we feel angry. Because anger is a natural response to social injustice. And I think that what we tell each other is that you shouldn't be angry and that anger is a bad thing. But I think anger's gotten a bad rap. I mean, I think that most civil rights movements and most collective actions against discrimination have been spurred by legitimate anger. Right. And so I think that we have to legitimize anger in those circumstances and allow people the space.
Because I think people are angry right now with everything that's been happening.
Yeah, and I think that's legitimate. I think there are many ways to use anger in productive ways to bring about healing, to mount an action agenda, and to really delve into the hard work of building more equitable systems and structures. And I think that if we can do that, then the anger serves a good purpose. So I think talking about it, taking a deep breath, allowing ourselves the space to heal and grow and reflect, and then getting to the work of actually collectively mounting action against the structures that enact these kinds of racist experiences and wreak havoc on the lives of those who are victimized.
Dr. Powell, I was reading a study. It was something that Essence did, and it mentioned that Black women are underdiagnosed when it comes to PTSD and other race-related traumas. Why is that? Are we more likely or less likely to be diagnosed?
Well, I think there are probably a number of probable causes for that underdiagnosis. And the one that comes to mind immediately is this notion of superwoman schema. And I have a colleague at UNC Chapel Hill, Dr. Cheryl Gascombe-Woods, who's amazing and does a lot of work around stress-related experiences in Black women. And she suggests that Black women adopt a coping style that is built on this notion of strength and vulnerability, and that leads to sort of taking on stress in a more stoic and private way. And I imagine that from a personal or an individual perspective, that if you have that kind of schema operating, then you're much more likely to underreport the trauma-related symptoms that you experience, to discount them, right? So that's one, at the individual level, I think that's a possibility. At the structural level and on the level of providers, it's probably operating in the same way, in that providers tend to view Black women as strong and capable of overcoming, stress in this sort of superhuman way, and they're less likely to see the traumas and to see the symptom manifestations that can exist in Black women. And so it could be that both are operating. At the very basic level, I think what we need to be thinking about is, are the criteria for PTSD sensitive enough to detect the kinds of trauma and stress reactions that may be operating for Black women, and they may appear differently, in a clinical context? That's a larger discussion, but something I think that's worth revisiting. But from an individual level, I think Black women are socialized to respond to stress in this way, and this was a survival mechanism. I mean, we survived, traumatic events during slavery, for example, that required us to shut down and minimize what we're experiencing. I mean, we could be whipped or punished, you know, for expressing, you know, pain or showing vulnerability. So there's a reason for this kind of adaptation, but I think it has consequences for our capacity to detect PTSD in Black women and also in Black men.
Because the Essence study said that roughly 30% of the respondents to this particular survey has some type of symptoms consistent with PTSD, and they said the rates were higher than that of veterans of Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. To me, that was really alarming when I read that.
Yeah, I mean, the reality, too, is that a number of people are likely walking around with these kinds of symptoms that have not been diagnosed or treated. Right. And so when you do a survey outside of a clinical setting, like in communities where I do most of my work, you're likely to pick up on more symptomatology than you would, say, if you just deal with a clinical population, because still Black people are less likely to utilize mental health services and to get treatment than non-Hispanic whites. So you're not capturing, I think, all of the potential cases when you conduct research and you estimate the prevalence of PTSD that way. So, you know, that's just a conundrum that we face in science, but I think it's worth mentioning, and it probably has a lot to do with why you saw such high rates in this study that you mentioned.
Has there been a lot of research done when it comes to race-related trauma? Because I was looking online for research, and I found your article, and I think I found a study Howard did maybe like 10 years ago, but that was about it. I really didn't find a lot of information about this particular subject and how race and PTSD, how they work together.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a tension in the literature, you know, around naming and calling race-related stress or race-related injuries trauma, because people feel, again, that, you know, using that kind of language to describe it often puts the victims in a pathological category, and that it also may be may dilute or oversimplify some of the symptomatology that may be specific to racism that may not be specific to the other kinds of catastrophic events that we normally associate with trauma. So I think that the research in the area is growing, but at a slower rate. There has been a lot of conceptual work done, again, by Dr. Robert Carter, around racism-related injury, and he takes on this topic as both a legal issue, but also as one that affects our capacity to diagnose the presence of anxiety in victims of racism. So I think that there are ways to read about and understand it, but I think we have a long way to go in understanding how people respond to and cope with and react to experiences of racism and what are the implications for health. I mean, we have some, you know, as you mentioned in the beginning of the show, strong evidence to suggest that racism exacts a physiologic, psychological, and physical health impact on those who are victimized. That data is fairly clear. So I think that we can build on that literature by now trying to get closer in time to when people experience it, how they respond and cope with it, to determine whether or not the events reach the threshold of something that could be characterized as traumatic.
Right. So earlier you mentioned that if people feel like they've experienced something and they need to get help, they should seek professional help. But what about for the rest of us who, as we were saying earlier, we're watching the news, we're on social media and keep seeing these events happening over and over again, and it's starting to affect us? What can we do to cope with what's kind of happening in the world today when it comes to race in America?
Right. I think that, you know, some of those suggestions I made earlier also extend to folks who are in communities, who are, you know, being exposed to these events in real time in social media spaces and otherwise. Well, the first thing, we can do, it's okay to catch your breath, meaning you can turn it off, right?
Right.
You can take a break from the Twitter feeds, from the Facebook posts, and you can just catch your breath, because we do need the space to be able to let these things process. I think that one of the things that gets us into trouble from a health perspective is when we develop these sort of unhealthy coping responses in the aftermath of these exposures. So, you know, instead of talking with someone, people can misuse substances or alcohol as a way to cope with, you know, these kinds of exposures. You could find healthier ways. Exercise is one. It works wonders in my life. And I think that folks could figure out, you know, and develop a strategy, a response strategy that includes more healthy coping responses. But the other thing is that you have to connect. One of the things we tend to do when we're stressed or when we experience trauma is to isolate. And I think that that is probably the most harmful, especially in a community where collectivism operates as the way that we function, you know, in a general sense. So I think you need to connect, you have to ventilate, and you have to, you know, get a set of strategies in place that will allow you to cope in a more helpful manner. And the other thing is just to just be real about what you're experiencing and not to discount and push it down. I think that's the first, you know, at least automatic reaction that can occur among people who don't believe they have a right to experience the symptoms related to these events.
Thank you so much. If people want to learn more about you, where can they go?
Well, I am currently at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, in the Gilling School of Global Public Health. So to reach me by email, they can simply email me at wisdom.powell@unc.edu. I'm on Twitter also at wisdomisms, WIZDOMSIMS. And if they want to reach me on Facebook, I'm also at Dr. Wisdom Powell. So I'm happy to continue this conversation with you in a later broadcast, but also to talk with folks offline.
Thank you so much. This was so helpful. You just heard from Dr. Wisdom Powell. She is the Assistant Professor of Health Behavior at UNC Chapel Hill. Up next is my grassroots giver, which is Free Minds Book Club and Writing Workshop. But first is my song of the day. I'm going to go old school. I'm going to do some Dunny Hathaway. The song is Lord Help Me by Dunny Hathaway. And you're listening to Empower Hour on 89.3 FM. And I'm your host, Deshauna Spencer.
Lord, help me. Me. Help me to inspire those that need inspiration. Let my life be a sign of a coming generation.
Lord, help me.
And I'm also asking you to help my brother. He needs help too, Lord. Realize all that God has given. Help him to know that there's a purpose for living. And oh Lord, hey Lord, I want you to help me see.
Help me.
we're back. This is Empower Hour on 89.3 FM. I'm your host, Deshauna Spencer. Now is my favorite part of the show. I'm talking to my grassroots givers in the studio. I have Free Minds Book Club and Workshop with me, Tara Liebert, who is the executive director, and Eddie Christ, who is a Free Minds member. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm happy that you're here. If you have any questions or comments during this segment, you can call me at 202-588-0893 or hit me up on Twitter using the hashtag EmpowerHour. So let's just get right to it. What is Free Minds Book Club?
Well, Free Minds is a nonprofit based here in D.C., and we work with youth who are charged as adults at the D.C. jail, and we use the tools of books, creative writing, and community engagement to awaken these youth to their own potential so they can have positive futures and be community change agents. We're really working to stop the violence in the city.
So how long has the organization been around, and why was this organization started in the first place?
Yeah, it's been, believe it or not, 13 years, and we've worked with almost 1,000 young men. And
that's awesome.
It started really as a total volunteer thing. Like, if you said to me I would be here now with this working on the nonprofit, I would have never believed you. I and my good friend Kelly Taylor were television news producers, and we had done many stories on crime. And a young man named Glenn McGinnis wrote to Kelly while we were working together at Australian television, and he was on death row, and he basically was trying to let the world know how many young men of color were on death row and what was going on. So Kelly did a documentary, and then we tried to stay his execution, but were unsuccessful. So that was in the year 2000. He was executed in the state of Texas. And we were just so, we felt so powerless, so hopeless about a system that would take a young boy. He was 16 when he committed his crime. And he loved books and writing. He was the original Free Mind. And we said, let's, in his honor, keep his spirit alive and try to prevent other young men from going down that tragic path. So we just started it to see how it would happen. And we do a book club just like any other book club. We meet twice a week at the D.C. jail just for youth, the 16 and 17-year-olds that are charged with felony crimes in the adult system. And we meet wonderful people like Eddie. And the minute we did, they loved it. And so here we are. We've grown based on the needs. We do, that's the first phase, the book club and the writing. And then they go to federal prison. And D.C. doesn't have Lorton anymore. You know, it's not a, as we all know, we're in the federal system. So we have kids just all over the country, Arizona, California, and they can't be connected to their families. Their families can't visit them. So we send them books, a newsletter, birthday cards. We just say, you are not alone in this really horrible experience in federal prison. And then when they come home, we do a paid job readiness apprenticeship for a month, and we place them in jobs where they learn on the job. And then the most exciting part I find is what Eddie does, he's going to talk about today, is our violence prevention. So the young men, we call them poet ambassadors, and they represent all of the other members who are still incarcerated. And we go to schools, we talk to high-risk kids, and we say there is another future besides prison or dying before the age of 21. And it works. It's a really powerful way to connect with these kids.
Yeah, it's just even the name Free Minds, because you think about when you're in prison, you're not free, but when you write, I'm a writer, I'm a storyteller, but when you write, you are free. So I do want to talk to you, Eric. You were 17 when you got involved with the program. How'd you learn about it?
Well, what we did was Free Minds basically did a book club every Thursday, and what they did was bring in books. We did poetry. We read about different parts of the book, and we got a good understanding of what the book was about. We also got skills on poetry and art, and it helped us a lot.
So I'm pretty sure it's a life-changing experience for you.
Absolutely.
That's totally awesome. And Tara, I know you work with people say that in the D.C. area about illiteracy being an issue. Is this program in a way also helping to address that?
Right. A lot of people say, wow, you have to have young men that are readers. We're like, absolutely not. Actually, we want
the ones come that struggle with reading and writing. And we've had members that couldn't read at all. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't, they still participate because the books are about characters that look exactly like them, that have had the experience. And we have a whole book list on our website that we encourage all the listeners to go to, because we've proven them that they really engage young readers. And we'll talk about the book, and then it goes right to the discussion. So it's like, how does this relate to your life? So Makes Me Want to Holler by Nathan McCall, you know, as a young kid growing up, got in trouble in the streets. Like, how did you, are you similar to him? How are you different? So even if you can't read the book, you participate in the discussion. Right, right. And it's so exciting that it spurs you to want to learn how to read. And mm-hmm. they help each other. The brotherhood that's formed in the book club is really powerfully amazing. And then the writing part, sometimes they can't write, so they'll dictate it to us and we'll write it down. And it's just, you know how it affects you, that expressive writing mm-hmm. is really transformative. We always say, they say, I can't write, I have so much on my head, I'm so stressed out about my mom, she's sick, or, you know, what's going on the outside. And we say, just try to write about it, and then it just, it changes the whole attitude toward it, and then they can share it in the group, and then the group bonding occurs, and the people say, you know what, my mom's sick too, or mm-hmm. you're not so alone with all of your struggles. So, and then we have a book today we're going to give you, we're announcing today, we have a launch of a new literary journal, which is a collection of the poems from our members.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes, great. So it's actually our second one, and this one's really exciting because we have profiles of our members who are home and doing really well. A lot of people think, oh, you were locked up in the adult system as a youth, forget about it. Mm-hmm. Like, you're just going to be going in and out, cycling. And we're here to tell everyone the good news that with the right support, it's not true. And we have many working members who have completely changed their lives around, our good fathers, good brothers. I mean, it's just, and are really trying to change the city for the better.
I think that's so important that you mention that, because I speak a lot to high school students. Like, that's my thing. I don't like the little ones. I have to go to the bathroom. Whiny, whiny. I like the older kids. I like the lean on me kids, as I actually like to say, lean on me kids. But people don't think, oh, well, once someone turns 16 and they make one mistake, then that's it. And then people write them off. And to me, your program's giving people a second chance. I mean, Eric, I'm pretty sure for you, this was a second chance experience for you.
Yes, ma'am.
So, but before you got into this program, and now that you've been a part of this program, how has it changed your life?
Well, first of all, like Tara said, a lot of us wasn't readers and writers. I was a writer, but I wasn't a reader. I didn't write that good, but I write better now. So, it was a life learned lesson, and the experience that I got now is way better than it's ever been before.
And you mentioned too about the writing experience. Writing is a very intimate thing to do. It's something you're opening up yourself to people. And I can imagine that maybe the first time a lot of people may, like you mentioned, they were afraid to do that. How do you help people open up? I mean, Eric, how are you able to open up and express yourself amongst your other friends who were in prison with you at the time?
Well, first of all, it started from, a lot of my poetry came from me going through something and me learning a lesson from it and making bad choices. Then how I taught it to them from learning my own mistakes, I taught it to them by giving them encouragement, letting them know some of the things I accomplished and the understanding of certain things and different ways you can put it. So that's how I passed it on.
I think also you were saying in the book, the guys that have more courage are able to share, share their poem, like Eddie. Mm-hmm. I remember we were talking about one of your first poems was about forgiveness, and it was a really dramatic moment when he was saying, I forgive a lot of my family members for doing some really hard betrayal. And mm-hmm. And then they see their peers do it, so then they say, oh, it's okay. And it's a safe space to write. That's our number one thing. You have to make sure that it's safe. It's like whatever happens in the book club
stays in the
stays
book club.
It's
like Vegas,
club.
Whatever happens in book club. Yeah, because it's a very, very intimate space. You mentioned some of the things that you went through, Eddie. I'm pretty sure a lot of the people that you deal with, Tara, in the program have probably gone through some type of traumatic experience. A young person doesn't end up in prison for no reason. Obviously, they went through something.
Yeah, and that's why we're so thrilled to be able to get that message out. That's our name of our literary journal is The Untold Story of the Real Me. And so many people, when you read in the news, you think, oh my gosh, these kids are just unredeemable and violent and, you know, super predators, all those sensational news. And we say, that's obviously not the story, right? Hurt people, mm-hmm. and what happened to you before you even came to the jail. And so by that process of reading about other people that have gone through the same thing and identifying with them and then beginning that process of writing your own story, and then we share it with the community, and it's been, the only word we say is magical, because we do these things called write nights, mm-hmm. where anyone can come, and we'll let your listeners know. We provide all the poetry, the members that want to have it out in the community, and they read it and write comments on it. So, for example, someone says, you know, I lost my dad. My dad was never there for me. And then someone in the community can say, you know what? I know what that pain feels like. And then they sign their first name, and then we send it back to our members. It's like all of a sudden this connection mm-hmm. is made, even though totally strangers, but through that poetry, through that art form. And that's really healing. That's really, I think it's just, there's so many issues that we face with that these kids come with, and we realize, what can we do? Well, we can put a pen in your hand and a book in your hand. We can say, go on an inner journey and start to believe in yourself, that you have the grit and the resilience to make it through. And that's what I think is so exciting. Mm-hmm.
Because I think a lot of times kids don't hear that they can be anything. I remember growing up, people kind of wrote us off. And, you know, now it's just been a continuation. I'm pretty sure, Eddie, you felt that growing up as a kid.
Yeah. See, what my situation is that in a lot of our situation, I'm going to speak for all of us, a lot of our situation is not having a support in our household, like, just having a mother but not the father, or just having a father and not the mother, or just not having nobody at all, and just having the not having the understanding of, or not having an open ear for you can speak to. So
right.
That's where it started at.
But you know, one thing you say about people, the messages we do for our reentry apprenticeship, we say, what's the worst thing anyone's ever said to you when you told them you wanted to change your life, like after you left the streets, and what's the best thing? And it's heartbreaking, because so many of them will say, oh, well, you're better off in jail,
mm-hmm.
or you're just going to head back there anyway, so we don't even believe in you. So these messages, really hard to fight. They're crushing.
Right.
So, but as the group, as a brotherhood, you can go to a fellow Free Minds member and say, you know what, that's what someone told me that too, and I'm not going to pay that any mind, and you are somebody. And, you know, it's really important to have that peer support, is what we call it.
And you also have professional writers come into the prison as well. I know Hill Hopper, I read that he came. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
It was so exciting. Oh my gosh. We were laughing so hard. We said, Hill Hopper, are they going to have like security? Because they had all the things. And one of the correctional officers says, we're having security from all the female correctional officers from like going up to him.
Oh,
we were laughing so hard. Being like, Hill
Hopper. He looks great for his age. He's like 49 or something. He looks like he's 20.
No, it does. And he's just a wonderful spirit.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's just a down to earth, genuine guy. That's what I love, when you find out mm-hmm. celebrities are the real deal.
Mm-hmm.
But was anybody there, Eddie, when you were, did you get any authors? We try to bring them in like as maybe 3 or 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember?
When I was dead, no.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, I didn't get a chance to meet Hill Hopper. What? People got a chance to meet Hill Hopper? I missed out.
Poor Eddie was in the beginning days. Now we have more. So we have Hill Hopper. We have George Pelicanos, a local writer who's amazing. Shaka Sengor, he served 19 years for murder in his home and wrote a book that I recommend for everyone. It's called Writing My Wrongs, W-R-I-T.
You read that, Eddie?
I read it.
Okay, good.
What do you like about that?
We actually had lunch together. So
wow, nice.
Sit down and talk to him, and you know.
What was his advice for you?
His advice was just to like, just go with the flow and like, just tell your life experience. Like, a lot of people would like to hear your life experience, and a lot of us are stuck in this comfort zone where we don't want to tell nobody about our life.
Or even think maybe your life is even worth telling. But everyone has a story, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And that healing, I'm amazed what our members share, you know, and then the healing that comes out from it, you know. In the beginning, when you say, you might say in the group, oh, wow, he's really vulnerable, and he shared that. But everyone's supportive. It's really pretty amazing. Wouldn't you agree, Eddie? They just know. It's a really wonderful thing. And it happened, so Eddie was home, so we got, he just came recently, so he came, we had lunch after he came to the jail, which was great. But yeah, if you know any authors, we're always looking to bring, because it's an exciting day, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, you came, every time, the first time we had an author, we said, they're gonna come, and we've had, Walter Dean Myers, we have like really big names, and they said, they're not coming. They didn't believe us.
Right, because if you think I'm in prison, why would someone care, right? I would think, I've never been in prison, but I would like, why would someone come to see me? So
Exactly. So, but it gives them the possibility. We had, right. Oh my gosh, now I can't even remember his name. Jonathan Franzen, super mm-hmm. famous. He won, you know, a lot of the book mm-hmm. awards. And they said, what do you do when you write? And he said, I lock myself in a small room, and I have no internet, and I have no phone, and I just write. And they said, oh my God, that sounds like solitary. You're doing it willingly, and you're writing. He said, well, you're writing too. So it's just like you make connections from people mm-hmm. that are totally different backgrounds through that art of writing.
And I think people think that there's in a way they can make a difference. I can't relate to this person because this person's been in prison, but I haven't been in prison. So there is no way there isn't a connection, but there is. We still all have our own issues, and we all have similar experiences in life.
Yeah, that's our number one message, the universal emotions. And that's what we have to do to solve this epidemic of over-incarceration is we have to see each other as people and solve problems together. We have one of our members writes a poem called Ghost Dad about how his dad always disappointed him. He kept wanting him to come, and he never came. And, when we go to the schools, all those kids are like, I see that too. All the teachers, when we go to colleges, when we go to businesses, like, I don't care who you are, how much money you have, where you're from, where you live, we've all had disappointment mm-hmm. from people in our lives. We have another poem called Mommy with one of our members talking about his mom who was addicted to crack. And it said, the most beautiful flower on God's green earth and the most wretched weed when she was addicted to crack and then when she wasn't. And we had, we went to a write lunch at a business, and one of the top CEOs said, you know, it's like when my mom, who's depressed, when she was depressed, she wasn't there for me, and when she was, then she was. So I totally relate. I know nothing about crack cocaine, but I know that feeling of wanting your mom to be there for you. So that's really what we're trying to stress, this connection. We're doing it through the poetry.
Talk about the poet, being a poet ambassador. No, Eddie, you're one. Talk a little bit about what you do when you talk to young people, right, in schools?
Okay. Well, basically, what I do is we go in, we introduce ourselves, we tell them what we was incarcerated, what was our charges, what we was incarcerated for. We tell them about our life experience, about the bad choices we made, and we tell them what we're doing now, like what are some of the goals we accomplished. And we basically get them a feel of just because you in jail, you can still accomplish goals and you can still make your future better for yourself.
Are you going to say something?
Oh, no, I was going to say, we have one of our poet ambassadors says, I wish I could be you in this seat. You know, I dropped out of school, and I would give anything to go back to school. So I think it's a real thing, appreciate what you have with the school. So we talk to all different kinds, kids that are struggling, kids in juvenile detention centers. We go to New Beginnings, YSC, but also, like, very well-resourced private schools. Like we were saying earlier, they'd be like, oh, I would never come in contact with kids that are in jail, and they're like, oh, you're exactly like us. We're like, that's how it works.
So regular kids just, you know, get caught up. And then it makes me think about, too, with President Obama. I mean, there is an issue with over-incarceration where a black person could have just a small amount of marijuana and they get more time than a white person. So we know that it is an issue. So it's not just because a kid is a bad kid. It's just, unfortunately, the system is also corrupt.
Oh, yeah. No, the disproportionate minority contact in youth is a real, real problem. I mean, we've been at the jail for 13 years. I have never seen a white inmate. Maybe there's been a couple of adults, but never for the youth. And we just know that it's the same things are happening out out there. And it's just that safety net. And also what I find is once you're in the system, you know, in the school to prison pipeline, it's so hard to get out. It's like quicksand, right? So you have a record, you come home, you're on probation, and then you violate. And then immediately they look at your record and they say, oh, well, of course you were in for that violent charge. And now, and no one ever looks at the individual case. It's this big system. And so I think that is what we have to stop and realize, like, look at the individual cases and change the system. It's not one size, like, oh, because you're at this level and you were at this prison, that means you're going to act this way.
Right, right.
I see that all the time. Don't you, Eddie, with the, your people assume.
Absolutely.
And Eddie, I see you have a book open that people can't see because there aren't cameras here. So I'm assuming that there's something that you've written in this new book.
Absolutely.
Okay, we have about 2 minutes left, so if you want to read it, you can, okay, long as it's G-rated.
Absolutely. It's a poem that I wrote in our new book called The Untold Story of the Real Me. I got chapter 11, and the name of the poem is called A Pencil in My Hand. And I'm basically just expressing myself.
Okay.
I've never actually written much of anything before. I didn't write about my life until I was 17 years old. That's when I got incarcerated and I wanted people to understand and relate to my experience. It felt so good. I felt like the paper was listening to me. I consider myself a writer now. Absolutely. I especially like to write when I was going through some difficulties. It relieves a lot of stress and helps you let go anger that you feel inside. If a person just writes, he can keep a lot of bad things from happening. When I write, I feel great because it's mine. I did it, and no one can take it away from me. When people read my work, they tell me things like, keep up the good work and stay strong. Hearing things like that, it makes me feel like I'm connected to the world.
Thank you for sharing that. Thank you so much. How can people get involved? We're out of time, but how can people get involved with the organization?
They can go like us on Facebook, Free Minds Book Club and Writing Workshop. They can go to our website, freemindsbookclub.org. They can follow us on Twitter. They can Google us. You'll find we've had some nice articles in the Washington Post. But really, and then come sign up for our newsletter. Go to our website and sign, and we'll tell you about all of our events.
Thank you. Just heard from Tara Liebert, who is the Executive Director for Free Minds Book Club, as well as Eddie, who is a member of Free Minds. So thank you so much for being on the show. The last word of the day actually comes from Jill Scott, who said, I think every individual has his or her own power, and it's a matter of working, taking time, and defining what that power is. So until next week, stay empowered.
With this deal, we have the possibility of peacefully resolving a major threat. With this deal, we have the possibility of peacefully. With this deal, we have the possibility of peacefully.
This is WPFW News. I'm Askia Mohammed. Here are some headlines at the 3 o'clock hour. The United States Navy said today that a shooting has taken place at a military facility in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where the mayor said there had been a horrific incident in the city. The Navy said on its official Twitter account that there had been a shooting at a building. Chattanooga police reported that the active shooter situation was over. Details, however, remain sketchy. The Associated Press, quoting a spokesman with the Army Recruiting Center in Fort Knox, Kentucky, said that a second shooting had occurred at a recruiting center nearby. WRCB-TV, a Chattanooga station, quoted Mayor Andy Burke as saying a police officer had been wounded, but it was not immediately clear whether the injury was connected to the Navy episode. President Obama has begun a campaign to defend the Iran nuclear deal ahead of an upcoming congressional vote. On Wednesday, Obama told reporters the deal was the only alternative to a nuclear arms race and more war in the Middle East.
With this deal, we have the possibility of peacefully resolving a major threat to regional and international security. Without a deal, we risk even more war in the Middle East, and other countries in the region would feel compelled to pursue their own nuclear programs, threatening a nuclear arms race in the most volatile region in the world.
Meanwhile, Israel continues to express opposition to the deal, arguing that a stronger Iran will threaten the region's stability. The New York Times reports that Israel has been requesting between $4.2 billion to $4.5 billion of military aid from the United States each year for the next 10 years in talks that began prior to the Iran nuclear deal's passage. Israel currently receives $3 billion a year in U.S. military aid. House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi said today that the nuclear deal with Iran has her strong support, and she would work to convince her colleagues to vote for it. Pelosi said she was optimistic about the deal's chances in Congress, calling the agreement the best possible option. Quote, "I'm very optimistic about our vote of support for the president," Pelosi said at her weekly news conference, where she held a copy of the nuclear agreement as she endorsed it. Pelosi's support is important to Democratic President Barack Obama's push for the nuclear pact to survive congressional review. Newly published National Security Agency documents leaked by Edward Snowden have revealed Israeli naval commandos were responsible for the mysterious 2008 assassination of a top aide to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Mohammed Suleiman was shot and killed by a sniper while he was holding a dinner party at his beachfront hotel in Tartus, Syria. Details of the assassination were included in a secret NSA document titled Manhunting Timeline, published by The Intercept on Wednesday. The Wall Street Journal is reporting the cost of police settlements for killings or misconduct has been soaring. Over the last 5 years, the 10 U.S. cities with the largest local police departments have paid a collective $1.4 billion in total settlements. More than $1 billion of that money went to cases involving brutality or wrongful imprisonment. New York City, with by far the largest police department, has paid out $600 million since 2010, the most settlements of any U.S. city. And Bank of America has announced a profit of $5.32 billion for this past quarter, double the profit that the bank reported last year during this same period. The past quarter's, that's 3 months' profit, amounts to about $59 million per day. Mostly sunny this afternoon.